From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. It was nice to have you with us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll start the week with an honest conversation about addiction, relapse, and recovery. Recovery Fitness is a local nonprofit that offers fitness and outdoor programs for people living in recovery. And Emily Balsh is a member.
She's been in recovery for 20 months now. She struggled with an alcohol addiction and an addiction to heroin, and she relapsed several times. In this clip, you'll hear her story, starting with when she knew she had an addiction.
Honestly, you know, I successfully completed drug court a few years ago. And if I look back now, I honestly don't even know if I was fully, like, honest with myself about how bad I was. Like, I actually have 20 months sober today, the longest I've ever been sober. And it's not because of courts. It's not to make family happy. And I've had a lot of realizations lately, you know. It's a mind game. It's crazy how my head works, at least. I can only speak for myself, but
I want to be careful when I ask about this one, but just because I hear a lot about the industry. You graduated SUNY New Paltz and started making your career as a chef?
Yeah, I wanted to go a different way, but I'm a convicted felon due to my addiction, so it's a little harder to find a path with a more professional career, but I've made a living cooking, yes.
I ask because there is at least a conversation about the fact that there is a higher level of, and please, restaurant listeners all around Rochester, please, no, I'm trying, I know this is going to be a generalization, I know it's not everybody, and I know it's not everywhere, and feel free to call me out if you think we're off base, but you hear that there's a little bit more either hard drinking or drugs in kitchens.
Oh, absolutely.
You would say yes to that.
Yeah, and I was working somewhere where I kept trying to force it to work because it was a nice salary, benefits, paid vacations, and I thought, you know, it was like that image of like, okay, I have something, I made it, and I kept trying to force it to work, and I kept relapsing. You know, and they'd take me back because I'm a good worker, but they'd be like, all right, go to detox, go to rehab, we'll hold your job for you. And that's not, I had to learn to care about myself, and I made some changes, and I don't work in like your typical restaurant now. It's more of a low-key thing, but for me, doing the next right thing for myself and learning to respect myself, I still make good money, I still get to cook, and it's the acceptance piece for me. Like, I had to accept that, like, certain atmospheres aren't healthy for me, and that's okay. Like, I was ashamed of it at first. Like, I should be able to go anywhere, do anything, but from learning who I am and knowing where I'm at on a specific day, like, I don't need to go certain places if it's not healthy for me, you know, and I'm okay with that.
Sure. And if that premise is true, why do you think there is a little bit more substance abuse in kitchens?
It's crazy hours. A lot of restaurants have bars in them, so, mm-hmm. you know, I started off as a heavy drinker, and then I ended up using heroin to quit drinking. That's, like, my delusional thinking, you know, because I can't drink when I'm using heroin, which helped me to hit my bottom a lot faster, at least, because alcohol is so accepted. But it's that party lifestyle, and I had that ego, and I had that mentality of, like, work hard, play harder, you know? And for someone with, like, the disease that I have, I can't be in that environment.
No, I hear you. But you truly were thinking, I've got to stop drinking, heroin will be that path?
Well, my drinking led me to end up in a very shady situation. And actually, while I was in college, I ended up in the Bronx, New York, with some strangers in my car shooting up heroin. And they gave me a bag for the ride down there from New Paltz that I had met in the bar while I was skipping class. And, you know, I had gotten home that night, and I was like, this is heroin, you know, you hear about it, I'm not going to do it. And 30 seconds later, I turned around and did it, and I fell in love. And it's been a problem ever since, and that was 2005.
Okay, and so when you say it's been a problem ever since, how quickly did you feel like, I mean, did you ever sort of, in those earlier days of doing it, think, I am addicted, or did you think, I can stop it, I like it, I'm going to go after it, I'm going to keep doing it? Like, what was the mindset?
Until I actually learned about alcoholism and addiction, mm-hmm. it was, like, my justification for why I partied so hard. Like, oh, I'm an alcoholic, it's okay, you know? But it's, like, I'm an alcoholic, and I need to do things to, like, take care of myself so I don't go down that path. You know, there was a period where I kept waking up really sick, and I wasn't making the connection that it was the drugs that was making me feel so bad in the morning, even though when I'd go and get them, I'd felt immediately better. But I was just so delusional. I didn't realize that, like, that was what was causing me to feel so bad.
So you're constantly chasing it, you know.
All the time.
All the time. Even when you wake up, it's almost like your body needs it right away or you're going to be sick.
By the end of this last time, I would be literally doing it and worrying about how I'm going to get more.
Dope sick all the time. Yeah. But when you say it wasn't, you know, certain things that pushed you to want to stop this, what was the driver, or what was there a day or a moment or an event that you said, like, enough?
Yeah. You know, in the past, like with drug court and like trying to make my family happy or people telling me I had a problem, it was always like this material image, like I need to have a place, I need to have a decent job. I was just broken, like so broken. Like I didn't want to live if I was high. I didn't want to live if I was sober. Like I didn't know what to do. And I had actually left detox Christmas Eve for like the second time while I had been back out. And, you know, when my mom was still here, she was talking to me every day. And I was, as always, trying to do things to make other people happy. But there was one night, and I'm not like a religious person or, you know, I got on my knees and I was just like, I give up and I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what to do. Like, just somebody help me. And I don't even know who I was talking to. But the next morning, I was able to text someone that I had been in contact with who works for SBH that I was telling I was fine, even though I just left there, and said I needed help. Like, I'm still using. And one of the last things she did before she left her job there was get me right back in. And that was January 4th of 2018, and I haven't looked back since.
Wow. How are you doing now?
I have a life I never even knew I wanted. And I have peace, and I have happiness. I'm able to give love to people. I'm able to receive love. I have connection from things like recovery and other, you know, resources. Like, I have such a gratitude for life that I never had my entire life.
Next, we sat down with two longtime local broadcasters to discuss the state of journalism. Alain Bienduty Hofer was a television and radio journalist right here at WXXI News for nearly 10 years, and Norma Holland was a reporter and anchor at Wham TV for 23 years. Both women left the broadcasting industry recently for new careers in journalism and digital marketing, respectively.
Evan asked them if they think it will always be more difficult for journalists of color to work in broadcasting, as in they will always have to work harder or take on more criticism than white broadcasters. You'll hear Norma's response, but first, here's Helen.
I don't mean to be the Debbie Downer of the group. I think we will always have that to a certain degree. I just think that's just how we are. I think as realistically optimistic as I am about this industry and our work and what we're doing, I do believe that we will always have that to a certain degree. Is it changing? Yes, I've seen. I've seen it in the almost 9 years that I was here, and just listening to NPR and also PBS as well. I watch the NewsHour all the time. I'm seeing that change and I'm hearing that change. But it's just one of those things. We just deal with it. We have to recognize the fact that I think something like that will always exist.
I don't know. I agree with Helen. Again, I'm not trying to be someone who is not optimistic, but honestly, I just. Growing up, look, we're going levels deep here, okay? You're talking to two biracial women who grew up, you know, probably being accused of trying to sound white. Mm-hmm. This is my voice. This is my voice. I'm not sounding like anyone other than who I am, right? But growing up, I mean, you heard it.
I mean,
it
you
all.
Do a wicked impersonation of your mother.
Oh, I do. Lucy? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's because that's Lucy's voice. Lucy. I can do Lucy's voice. Evan, she calls Evan Dawson the sausage man. She'd call him Bob Evans. I'm like, Mom, it's Evan Dawson, not Bob. But, you know, this is tough for me. This is emotional for me.
Yeah, yeah.
I should be in therapy for all the things that people have said over the years. I really should. But I think I developed a very hard exterior. maybe it'll come out years from now. I don't know. Maybe I'll write a book and people will think, who is that? I didn't know you felt like that, Norman. No, I worked with wonderful people who nurtured who I am. They did. Was the public always kind? No, many times they were not. Many times they were not. But many times they were great. And they allowed me to be who I am. But I am with Helene when I think that, yes, journalists of color will always have to, I'm going to say it, they have to work harder. They're going to have to work twice as hard. They are. They are.
And I think that it could change if we could look around our newsrooms around the country and see an accurate representation of our country in newsrooms.
Mm.
Because if we can see that, then I think that what you brought up, like, will this change? Yeah, I think that we could see the scale start to change just
yes.
a little bit. But we need an accurate representation of our country in our newsrooms. And we don't have that. And we know that. I mean, I know you've talked about that before. And I don't need to go down that trail again. But that's the problem. I mean, I think that's a major part of the problem.
Yeah, I agree. We need more voices
yeah.
of people that, and I don't mean, again, not how you speak, but I just think we need more experience. We need people of different backgrounds
yes.
to enrich our environments. And I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear people, what you're trying to, no, look, I want my daughters to see someone who looks like them
right.
or even can relate to their backgrounds. Do you know what I'm saying? And especially after having kids, I think about this a lot, right?
Yeah.
Who are my children watching?
Mm-hmm.
Who do they listen to? I don't think it's enough for them to just see it in their family. They need to see it on the air.
I got accused.
In the media they consume.
Yeah, I got accused on Friday. I made an offhand remark at the end of a conversation with four local comedians. And one of the people in comedy is a woman of color. And there was a lot of talk about later in the hour about sometimes people of color in mostly white comedy audiences feeling like, wow, like what happens to them when how they feel when racially charged jokes, racist jokes are being told. And then there was a lot of back and forth. And I just said, look, as the white guy with the microphone, there's enough of us. I'm going to let the woman of color close the hour because often women of color have not been given a microphone in this country. And this guy sends me you're just pandering. That was typical liberal stuff. You know, come on. You know, like this NPR virtue signaling. And I'm like, that is not. That's just reality. Why is this so hard for people? I'm a white guy. There's enough of us with microphones. The fact that I have this microphone in this job is a tremendous responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous responsibility to recognize that and what that means and to make sure that I'm aware and helping with some of the redress for that.
You make people uncomfortable when you say that, though.
But that's just being honest. That is not virtue signaling. I have probably, at times, I said if sometimes I've erred toward empathy or maybe even virtue signaled in the past because, look, I'm human. But that was not a case of it. That was just honest. And what you talk about, women of color in particular, but people of color having to work twice as hard, I'd like to think that's not going to be the case generations from now, but, you know, it probably will.
I hope it's not, but I think that that's where we are right now. And that's the truth. And that's perhaps an uncomfortable truth for
mm-hmm.
some people to accept.
Right.
But it is what I grew up being told by my own family, not by others outside of the family, but, you know, you will have to work hard, twice as hard, to be respected. That's the truth.
We'll end the week with a story about a remarkable teenager in our community. A local grassroots organization that works to address poverty in Rochester is expanding its services. Cameron Community Ministries has offered an after-school program for 35 years, and later this month, it will open a teen center for youth grades 7 through 12.
Kayla Toppin has benefited from Cameron Community Ministries since she was a young girl, and now as a teenager, she's a volunteer. You'll hear about her experiences, and you'll also hear from Jennifer Muniga, the executive director of Cameron Community Ministries. Here's Kayla.
I started off young in the after-school program, and then it would go to summer program, and then, you know, back and forth throughout the years. And then once I started getting older and I graduated throughout the program, I started volunteering. And Cameron has a scholarship program where we send some kids to private schools, like Mercy and McQuaid and Aquinas. So I did that, so I got into Mercy. And they, you know, helped me through everything, all my family issues and any problems I was going through.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so once I started getting older, I volunteer every summer and school year and after school program. And now since we're about to open the teen center, I'll be volunteering there, helping out with the kids there. So.
And are you still at Mercy?
Yes.
When's the first day of school?
On Friday.
It's on Friday?
Yeah.
Man, a lot of people are back today. I thought maybe they were letting you kind of get out early to come hang out in Connections. No, not till Friday.
No way.
I was going to say, that's very generous. When you talk about all the help that they have done for you and, you know, and the family challenges, how many of your friends your age have needed this kind of help that you've grown up with?
A lot. Like, most of my friends would definitely have benefited and would be, you know, different people sometimes or make better decisions through the programs that we learned. Like the girls group program at Cameron. It's called Respect and Responsibility, the R&R girls group. Like, if some of my friends maybe have been through that, have learned that, then they make better decisions, you know? So a lot of my friends could have.
And when you talk about decision making, give me an example of the kind of things that, again, it's not to kind of call out anybody individually, but the kind of things generally that you're proud that you made different decisions, but you might see where things can turn. What's the kind of thing that can happen?
Through the girls group at Cameron, they taught us a lot about, like, futures. And like she said, we went on college tours. Mm-hmm. And as, like, one of my friends, they don't go to school. They don't want to go to school. They have, you know, I'm not, like, trying to down my friend.
No,
but
no, I hear you.
The motivation piece is not there. And the way we talk at Cameron is all positivity, future, like, stuff like that.
Well, I think, and I want to bring Jennifer back in, it's a little easy and I think maybe precarious to generalize a view of kids who don't go to school as not caring or lazy. Whereas if you grow up in poverty, if you grew up thinking there aren't a whole lot of routes to being successful in life, then you're not probably thinking too much that college is a place for you anyway, I would think. What do you think?
Absolutely. That's right. And so that's why that exposure piece is so important. So we're giving them the support every day at Cameron, giving them the love and having them understand their potential, but then exposing them to those opportunities. So if they're not there, they don't go see the cool gym and, you know, facilities, cafeteria at Fisher, then they don't know that it's there. And so if they have that opportunity, they can say, oh, wow, this could be for me.
That is there and it's for them.
That's right.
Now, Kayla, what do you want to do? Give me a little timeline of what you'd like to do with your life now.
So I'm about to start 11th grade. So I want to finish these 2 years out at Mercy and get a scholarship to the University of Rochester to study biology, because then I go to medical school and I'll become a pediatrician. And that's what I'm going to do with my life.
And why is that a course you've decided you want?
Since I was real young, I wanted to, like, you know, help people. And, like, I really like kids. Like, I'm very good with kids. So that just seemed like a fit.
Are you patient with young kids?
I am.
Yeah?
Yes. I'm very good with kids.
She's very good with kids. And she's right that she has said that she wanted to be a pediatrician since the time I can remember. I've known her for 8 years.
It's awesome. Now, it's, you know, any kind of medical path has a long road ahead of it. And you've probably learned a lot about that.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the challenge?
So I'm up for it. I'm very, very resilient, especially, like, that's something that Mercy has taught me. I feel like it teaches you have to keep going. And that's also with Cameron. They have always pushed me. They have always, like, shown me that there's a way to get through it. So to be resilient and to keep going.
Do you talk to people your age, friends who maybe aren't thinking about school? Do you try to help them see the value?
I try a little bit. I don't like to tell them, you know, how to live their life, but I try to throw in little hints and try and get them to be, you know, their best self, the best they can be.
Absolutely. But I mean, I want to kind of build on what Jennifer and I just talked about and just ask you, very directly, if you think that some of the kids that you grew up with and some of the young adults now grow up thinking either college isn't a thing for me, it's not a thing I could afford, what is the mindset about a future that prevents some people, you know, your peers, from finishing high school or going to college?
So a lot of people might think, like you said, that they can't afford it. And, like, they get one thing in their head and it it downs the whole idea of going to college. Maybe they think it's too hard for them, or even like if they've never had the support, you know, that it would be too much to handle all on their own. And then, you know, a lot of people just stop thinking about college and even like dropping out of high school, you know? And then people also get distracted into other things.
Sometimes, Jennifer, it's just about making sure people understand that there can be a path for you. And that does not absolve a society that is pretty inegalitarian, that is pretty, it has a lot of work to do with opening paths. But the concern that I have is, you know, kids may grow up thinking, what is the point? Mm-hmm. There is no path for me. I'm not even going to finish high school. College isn't for me. It's not for someone like me. I don't. And if that is the mentality, that's really tough. But what you seem to be doing is helping change that mentality.
Yeah, that's right. And so if these kids don't see that, and most of them don't, the cycles of poverty are generational. And so if they don't have examples of people who look like them, are like them, came from the city, mm-hmm. then they don't think that that's something that's for them. And so that's exactly what we're trying to change.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS. That's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.
See ya.